Good afternoon. It's Wednesday, the 16th of January, 2019, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. Your host today, Mike Robinson, myself, Brian Gerrish.
Well, we're going to torment our viewers and listeners a little bit today, Brian, but we'll start with this.
The eyes to the right, 202. The nose to the left, 432.
The nose or dare? The eyes to the right, 202. The nose to the left, 432. So the nose have it. The nose have it. Unlock.
Unlock. It's just a comedy show, Brian. Absolute comedy show. Well, the vote is what it is. What was the European reaction to it? Well, here we go with, this is Le Monde. British MPs reject massively, 432 votes against 202. The agreement with Brussels on the exit of the UK from the European Union, a defeat more stinging than the most alarmist forecasts. And Le Figaro, well, they were saying Brexit, Theresa May's plan massively rejected. The Germans had quite a useful cartoon on the front page of this particular website. Britain has become somewhat ungovernable. Was it ever governable? That's the question. The behaviour of MPs in the House of Commons. I don't really know what to say about it. But anyway, Theresa May then had a statement prepared. So let's listen to a little bit of that.
Point of order, the Prime Minister.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, the House has spoken and the Government will listen. It is clear that the House does not support this deal, but tonight's vote tells us nothing about what it does support. Nothing about how... Nothing about how or even if it intends to honour the decision the British people took in a referendum Parliament decided to hold. With your permission, Mr. Speaker, I'd like to set out briefly how the Government intends to proceed. First, we need to confirm whether this Government still enjoys the confidence of the House. I believe that it does, but given the scale and importance of tonight's vote, it's right that others have the chance to test that question if they wish to do so. I can therefore confirm that if the official opposition table a confidence motion this evening in the form required by the Fixed Term Parliaments Act, the Government will make time to debate that motion tomorrow. And if, as happened before Christmas, the official opposition declined to do so, we will, on this occasion, consider making time tomorrow to debate any motion in the form required from the other opposition parties, should they put one forward.
Well, Jeremy Corbyn then did go and put a no confidence motion forward, and that is being discussed today. Prime Minister's questions going on today, the same type of buffoonery taking place there. So the question is the House of Commons, is Parliament going to respect the vote of the referendum or not? The bottom line, though, is the question is, does Theresa May's deal respect the referendum or not? She maintains that it does. Others would have a different view. I think we would have a different view on that. This was typical. This is typical of the sort of response. This is from Tobias Elwood. Reality check following defeat. Parliament is now in control. It has no appetite for no deal. And consensus is likely to lead to a lighter Brexit than offered by PM's deal or no Brexit. Defaulting to WTO terms was not in our party's manifesto and is not in Britain's interests. We'll come on to that a little bit more in a second. From the European side, the response was pretty similar. A hard Brexit would hurt the EU and Britain. Everyone in Europe would lose. No one would win, said the German economy minister. But going back to last night in the House of Commons, we had Joe Swinson saying we need to give the people their say on the Prime Minister's deal in a second referendum. And really, my question is why? Parliament has voted on Theresa May's deal. That deal is dead, it seems to me. There's no need for the public to have their say on the Prime Minister's deal, except for this. A number of people commented on the fact that outside the House of Commons yesterday, There were, you know, two main groups of protesters, some holding UK or some holding Union flags, some holding EU flags. And during the debate, during the day, these people were hurling abuse at each other. But as soon as the result came out, Brian, they were all on the same side all of a sudden, because it turns out that, of course, everybody was totally against this proposal from this deal from Theresa May. So the only reason that I can imagine that Joe Swinson would want the public to vote in a referendum on Theresa May's deal is so that there is no opportunity for anybody to call for a hard Brexit on that referendum. You know, so that is the issue. In the meantime, 71 Labour MPs are now urging Corbyn to get behind a second referendum. He, of course, has gone for the vote of no confidence.
You'll put that on screen.
Oh, sorry. Apologies
just
for that.
Just for our viewers.
Sorry. He has gone for the vote of no confidence, which he's hoping is going to result in a general election. That's extremely unlikely that vote of no confidence will be won. So there's not likely to be an election. So what is the outcome going to be? Probably a second referendum. In the meantime, of course, this is from before Christmas. The polls are clear. Support for staying in the EU has rocketed, according to The Guardian. Other mainstream media saying this. But the polls aren't necessarily quite so clear, because as the iNews reported yesterday or the day before, 70% of voters in Sunderland want a no-deal Brexit. So I actually think, Brian, that they are going to aim for a second referendum. I think if they do that, it's going to be very interesting to see what question they choose. But if they choose a question which involves a no-deal Brexit, they may get a surprise as to the result they get.
Yeah. Well, where do we start? I'm just going to comment on the scenes in Parliament. A packed house there for this particular subject. Utter chaos in Westminster. MPs who have no idea what's going on. Some of them are admitting this in the corridors of Westminster, that despite all the briefing papers, they still don't even understand their own party's policy. Or Labour is, of course, saying that they don't understand what the Conservatives are trying to put across here. So complete chaos, pantomime, theatre in Parliament, but the House is full. But on other major topics, whether it's industry, the creation of jobs, repairing the holes in the road, we get, what, 6 or 7 or 10 or 15 MPs who bother to turn up.
Or child abuse issues, where you get 5 MPs turning up. This is, you know, it's despicable.
Absolutely. So they're all in on this theatre. But what we are learning more and more is that the average backbench MP has absolutely no idea who is making the policy and what the policy is. Everything coming back to the Cabinet Office. And as we've said on several occasions now, we still don't understand how big that office is, how many people it employs. But backbench MPs simply unaware of the policy, how it's formed and where it's supposed to go. So they won't be involved in creating a new referendum, Mike. That'll be presented on a plate to them. They'll be told that this is the government policy and they need to follow it. And then we'll go off down the next street theatre session. And I noticed that Theresa May was in her blue jacket there. So she's worn all these other, well, I think it's significant. Mm. She's worn all these other clothes when she's been off hobnobbing with the European Union, especially her snakeskin jacket. But now she's back in, what do we call it? Blue rinse. This is getting the Tory image across, because, of course, her next problem is to keep people supporting the Labour Party, keep people supporting the Conservative Party. Freudian slip.
Yes.
Well, can we trust our MPs? We don't think so. And this is a report which really came out of the blue, dropped in out of the blue, because we had some information today which was about the training provision for RAF and Army air crews as well. But this was around some helicopters. One type is called Juno, the other type's called Jupiter. But these are training helicopters operating from, which are going to be operating from RAF Shrewsbury. And this has been reported with quite a lot of hype over the last year, 18 months. But suddenly we're getting a little bit more coming in. So let's have a look at what we were told. So this is a UK column viewer, and they say that they've got some very good information on the state of this tri-service Juno Jupiter helicopter project at Shoreby. This is what they're saying. Since the contract started last year, no aircrew have graduated. The syllabus has not been produced or signed off. Over 120 pilots are now effectively in a training holding pattern. And the aircraft themselves are not fit for purpose for rear crew training. So they're okay for pilots, but when it comes into tactical navigators, whatever else is going to go on, they're not. Numerous problems with the simulator complex. So once again, we've got a story which is put out by the MOD about the success of this particular thing. But what's coming in on the ground is we've got another disaster. We've seen it over the army recruiting. Now we're seeing it over another level, the training of helicopter pilots. So this is what the government put out back in May 2016. New helicopter deal boosts UK's investment in military flying training. And it's a £2.8 billion investment, of which a new contract worth £1.1 billion was awarded to, well, what does it say? It says to UK industry. Mm. So the British public led to believe that this massive amount of money was going to directly benefit UK industry. Well, we're going to say this was a lie, and it was a lie to hide EU military unification. So let's have a little look how this pieces together. First of all, very good report on what's going on in the background. So Aero Assurance, you might like to visit and have a look at this story for yourselves. But it basically says in the second major UK military flying training system contract award this year, Airbus Helicopters has won the contract to provide training helicopters for the RAF, Royal Navy and Royal and Army Air Corps until 2033. Airbus will supply and maintain 29 H-135s, that's one version, the Juno, and three larger H-145s to be given the name Jupiter. These will deliver up to 28,000 flying hours per annum. So if we've got a problem running at the moment, it's interesting to see. I think they mean the 28,000 when they get all the aircraft online, Mike. Otherwise, it's a bit extraordinary.
So that's Airbus, that well-known UK industrial organisation.
Indeed. Well, we'll come on to Airbus in just a minute. They said a bit more. The 500 million rotary wing aircraft service provision contract was placed by Babcock Lockheed Martin joint venture Ascent Flying Training. Ascent, selected as the UK MOD's flying training partner in 2008, were themselves awarded a £1.1 billion contract by UK MOD as prime contractor, which includes provision of infrastructure, simulators, training design and instructors, as well as subcontracting the aircraft provision. So where can we go? Well, you're absolutely right, Mike. Here's Airbus, described on the internet as the European Aeronautic Defence and Space Company, corporation registered in the Netherlands, trading shares in France, Germany and Spain. So all that looks pretty interesting. So the government pumped in the 2.8 billion. Now, Ascent was the name of the joint venture, 50% from Lockheed Martin, 50% from Babcock. So we've got a major US company taking 50% of this straight away. We've got an international company present in 130 countries, which is Babcock. Quite what the ownership of Babcock is, I still haven't pinned down, but we're going to call it international. And the contract ultimately goes to a European company, the Airbus Group. And this is the sting in the tail, because it was ultimately Germany that was building the helicopters. And we were told to be happy because on top of 220 existing jobs, there were going to be another 280 jobs created. So this, I think, is deliberate deceit of the British public, because this is not supporting UK manufacturing in any shape or form. What we've got going on here is EU military unification. And this is how the unified European procurement system works. You can't give the work to one national company. It goes into one of these conglomerates. And ultimately, of course, the host nation doesn't benefit from their own investment. So very clear. And I think we'll have more to talk about the defence industry in our coming UK column news.
Okay, let's go to France and the Yellow Vests. Now, there's been very little mainstream media coverage of this. Some articles, but nothing terribly significant. But this one from the Mail caught my eye. Shocking video shows fireman Yellow Vest protester shot in the back of the head by French police, leaving him with serious brain injuries as protests against Macron continue. So Olivier Béziade, a father of three, is in a coma after the Bordeaux shooting. The incident on Saturday, the ninth of the Yellow Vest anti-government protests, the ninth week of Yellow Vest anti-government protests. Mrs. Béziade's wife said police shot at them like rabbits as an inquiry is opened. So we've got the police shooting at Yellow Vests, people being hit. Actually, the death toll from the Yellow Vest protests before Christmas was 10. And there's been pretty much silence on the issue of how many deaths and injuries have been since Christmas in the British press anyway. And I haven't been following the French press close enough to keep track of it, I'm afraid. But I just wanted to draw the parallels here, because we now have protests going on in France and people being shot with live fire, Brian. But in 2011 in Syria, we had the same mainstream media alleging that the Syrian government was shooting protesters on the streets of Syria. And that resulted in aerial bombardment, in invasion by foreign
troops,
combatants who were being supported by the British, American, French governments. So I would like to get an answer from the mainstream media, please, as to where this hypocrisy ends. Because nobody in the mainstream media is calling for an invasion of France at this point in time.
Well, they're not even pointing a finger at Macron. If this was in America, we would have the BBC festooned with attacks on Trump, probably on the American police themselves. But at the moment, particularly from the BBC, we've got a wall of silence over what's really happening in France. So there's no full reports on the ordinary people in France who are standing up saying we've actually had enough of what's going on. There's no BBC coverage of the overwhelmingly peaceful part of these protests. And now the authorities are shooting people, which Macron said he was happy to do as he brought in, I think it was a total of 80,000 troops. Police and troops supposed to be used across France. We haven't got any reports at all from the BBC in particular.
No, and the question is, what nationality are the people that are firing these weapons? Because there seems to be a growing body of evidence to suggest that Eurogen 4 is involved in policing these protests. So if we've got Greeks or Belgians or some Germans coming into France to
other nationalities.
Then, you know, the chances of this type of incident happening must be increased.
One would have thought so. And of course, this is the danger of Eurogen 4, particularly when the European policing system is intimately linked to the military in a way which it isn't in UK. Again, this is something which the BBC simply fails to investigate or comment on.
Now, many people will know the name Pippa King, because Pippa has been highlighting the issues of surveillance in this country for many, many years, began with her work on surveillance in schools and is much broader now. And she drew my attention to this article in Devon Live for a few days ago. Everything we need to know about the new yellow vulture speed cameras now installed in Devon. Now, we know that in France, as part of the Yellow Vest campaign, that something like 60% of the speed cameras in France have now been immobilised by the Yellow Vests in some way, shape or form. Perhaps we need a bit of this activity in this country. I wouldn't call for that, but you know, maybe it wouldn't be a bad thing to see, because this is now getting beyond a joke. So what this article is saying is souped-up speed cameras so powerful that they will catch you tucking into a sandwich behind the wheel have arrived in Devon. They've also arrived in other parts of the country as well. Traditionally, traffic cameras will only detect speeding, but these new yellow vultures will know if you're wearing a seatbelt, if you're using your phone, eating or drinking or smoking inside your car. Now, I'm not aware that it's illegal to smoke inside your car, Brian, but apparently it's going to know that. So Pippa has put in a Freedom of Information request, and these are the questions he's asking. The article claims that these new yellow vultures will know if you're not wearing a seatbelt, using your phone, eating, drinking or smoking. Please list all the objects and activities that the camera system can recognise in the vehicle and advise which object and activity detection will be operational. Because the key point is here, this is now looking inside your vehicle. These cameras are provided with night vision and infrared lights, so they will be able to see what's going on inside your car as you're driving along, even at night. She goes on to ask, please supply an example of the camera view into the vehicle, i.e. where the image of the object or activity may be captured. Please advise the company supplying the Yellow Vulture camera system. Please supply the privacy impact assessment for the camera system. Please supply minutes of meetings and electronic communications such as emails, internet postings, text messages and instant messages where specifically the camera system's capability to recognize objects and activities within the vehicle was discussed. Please advise what advice or recommendations have been taken for the camera system and from whom, specifically with regards to camera system's capability and recognition of objects and activities within the vehicle. And please advise if you're aware of other camera systems that are operational within the capabilities of recognising objects and activities within the vehicle. So a pretty comprehensive request for information there, Brian, but it does seem that this is now taking a step beyond what we're used to, even in this country, which is probably the most surveilled country, possibly outside of China, on the planet.
Very, very dangerous events around these cameras, Mike. And I'm one of many people who will remember life before the cameras. Of course, we were told that we needed the cameras for safety. We needed cameras for safety in cities. We needed cameras for road safety to cut down speeds. But actually, what have we seen them used for? We've seen them principally used to raise money through the fines. And now we're seeing exactly how invasive these things can get. If you come to Plymouth now, of course, and you approach the city from the east, you're immediately into Yellow Cameraville the moment you get to the city borders, with average speed checks of 30 miles an hour on dual carriageways, which public money built in order to try and speed up the traffic flows. So Plymouth has now got some very unusual cameras. I still don't know what they are, but we've got lampposts with four sort of square looking cameras which are pointed right at the sides of the car. We'll have to do a little more work on what those are, but Plymouth, like many other cities, becoming surveillance cities at all levels. Are they going to be watching what you're doing inside the car? I think absolutely, if people allow it to happen.
Okay, now we've had a tip-off, speaking to Ian Crane this morning, we've had a tip-off that a number of alternative media outlets, Ian Crane's name is mentioned, UK Column's name is mentioned, 21 Wire, Vanessa Bealey and so on, the usual suspects are about to come under a pretty sustained integrity initiative style attack, is how it was described to me. We don't know exactly what form that's going to take, but certainly social media is going to play a large part. But in the meantime, here we've got Freedom. Well, who is Freedom? They are an anarchist website, and they, an independent, radical co-op controlled by its volunteers. Freedom runs Britain's oldest anarchist press and its largest bookshop, apparently. Well, they've started the first major attack of 2019, radical media and the blurred lines of red fascism. So the looks at the modern rise of red-brown politics and its infection of the left through the lens of recent Indymedia On Air showing with prominent radical media figure Chris Burnett, which gave a sadist hardliner Vanessa Bailey a platform offering oddly softball questions. It then goes on to accuse Vanessa of being a fascist. The fascist in question is Vanessa Bailey, a British alternative journalist who runs interference for Assad and Putin. And then it goes on to attack 21 Wire and, you know, suggesting that they're Holocaust deniers, that because they have interviewed Gilad Atzmon.
Who is Jewish, of course.
Who is Jewish, but yes. Is called an anti-Semite and a Holocaust denier. So so the attacks already coming thick and fast. But apparently it's going to get much worse in the coming year. So we look forward to that.
Well, Mike, if we've got a spook now heading up our civil service and we've got a cabinet office department which is going to be looking at fake news and trying to deal with alternate, they've got to have a job to do. Mm. Somebody's being paid a lot of money. We still don't know how big the teams are to do this. I find it very significant that they're going to go in through social media because we'd certainly welcome a full frontal discussion with the mainstream media on a number of topics, but we just don't seem to get that. We don't seem to get anybody from mainstream media picks up a phone and asks us a question about why we're reporting as we are on a particular subject or where we get the information from. There's just a wall of silence and we're not mentioned as if we don't exist. And then what do? They try and go through the back door with social media. So my take on this, my personal opinion, is that they're showing just how problematic mainstream media has become. People are not taking it serious. It's not even seriously, it's not even brave enough to have a go at us.
Mm.
So we'll see what happens. Well, what can the BBC report? It can't report deaths in France. That's not worthy of reporting. But money on statues of Satan in Spain is absolutely newsworthy for the BBC. So this is a sculpture which hasn't yet been put in place, but it's at the moment plans are afoot to get this sculpture put in place. And there's been some protests, but you wouldn't imagine that from the BBC. If we look at the Mail report on this, it gets quite interesting because they do start to give you a little bit of the background. Diabolical Spanish city protests over new sculpture of Satan smiling and taking a selfie because he looks too friendly. It goes on to say the bronze statue was designed to tell a local legend to tourists who visit Segovia. More than 5,500 residents have signed a petition calling for it to be scrapped. Critics say the jovial statue is offensive to Catholics due to the portrayal of the devil. Now, I'm going to say we criticise the Daily Mail quite a lot, but the minimum you can say about this article is at least they've covered part of the story. So we've got some detail. It's a 1.7 metre bronze statue. I would imagine that was quite expensive to commission and cast, Mike, in bronze. But apparently the sculptor is sort of paying for it himself. Jose Antonio Abella says that actually this is his idea and he's doing it. And it's to tell the story that in myth, the devil was brought in to create, I think it was a viaduct. And because 800,000 tourists a year visit Segovia, he thought it would be a good idea for him to put his smiling Satan statue on the aqueduct maybe. So here's the Mail. More than 10% of the city's population, around 5,500 people, have signed a petition for it to be cancelled. So what sort of things were they saying? Well, they were saying that the sculpture was offensive to Catholics due to the jovial way the devil is portrayed. The organiser of the petition, Maria Esther Lazaro Hernandez, wrote, "The representation they want to make reflects a devil jokingly with a mobile phone in hand." And this last one, I think the English is a little bit off, which is interesting because it slightly undermines what the lady was saying, but let's report it as the paper reported it. This representation is offensive to Catholics because it supposes an exaltation of evil and using the name of God on what most repulses produces a Catholic who is the devil. So I think what the lady's basically saying is that this is exalting evil, and if you're a Catholic following the name of God, then you're going to be repulsed by this. But at least the Daily Mail got some part of the main story in. If we go to the BBC, it's very interesting what they do. They have the massive picture of the smiling face, and the caption reads, "Residents say that Satan's face should not appear so friendly." So I think that's a fairly gentle little BBC spin. It's all a bit of a joke. So they've got a nice big friendly smiling Satan there. This is some of the rest of their report, which is all about the sculptor himself and how he's devastated, really, that people haven't really liked the idea of putting his sculpture forward. He says he loves Segovia. He's lived here for three decades, and he was hoping for the sculpture to be a form of demonstration of how thankful I am to Segovia for being my adopted town. So the BBC fully behind the sculptor, and they put out all of his pleadings that he's really devastated that people don't like it. And then they say this, that a councillor, Claudia De Santos, told the local newspaper that she would try to ensure that the sculpture goes ahead as planned. So the BBC very cleverly ends with a positive point. Let's get this sculpture in place. And it makes absolutely no comment from any of the 5,500 people who've said this shouldn't take place. So I just find this a very carefully crafted BBC piece of reporting. I regard it as clearly being pro that smiling Satan, with no proper investigation as to why people are concerned. I'll then just remind our viewers and listeners that back in 2004, the BBC was pretty keen on reporting that the Royal Navy had approved its first ever Satanist. And from that moment on, Satanism as a form of worship was approved on board British warships. And that story, of course, also picked up by CNN on the right and other media outlets. So make your own mind up, but very interesting and clever, creative reporting by the BBC on that very emotive subject.
Well, The Guardian here saying, what exactly is Trump's border wall and why does he want $5.7 billion for it? And of course, the mainstream media in the UK very keen to make a big deal of the fact that the government is shut down in the United States, that Trump is sticking to his guns on the border wall. Now, just to put this in a little bit of perspective, why has this happened and why has it happened now? Well, Trump has attempted, I think, on three occasions now to get funding for the wall, for the border between the United States and Mexico. Each time it's been delayed, and he said, well, okay, don't mind if you delay it, so long as you actually come up with a budget for this the next time we come back on it. The Democrats have put their gotten in the way each time, and he's finally put his foot down. But I wanted to highlight on what The Guardian is saying here, because they're saying, what exactly is Trump's border wall? Why does he want to spend this money on it? They say the president backed away from his threat to declare a national emergency over the wall, but his preoccupation with it persists. Donald Trump may have backed away from a threat to declare a national emergency, but what exactly is the wall? Why does he want to fund it? Here are some answers to his key questions. They talk about the length of the border and all this kind of stuff. What does he want to do? Details are thin, they say, and what would actually come from the $5.7 billion wall. In recent weeks, Trump's language has shifted from calling it a wall to a barrier, and he's conceded it doesn't have to be concrete. The barrier or the wall can be of steel instead of concrete, if that works better, he said early this month, they report. I intend to call the head of United States Steel and a couple of other steel companies to have them come up with a plate or design. We'll use that as our barrier. And so really the Guardian doesn't know, or at least they claim they don't know why he's doing it. It's just about immigration, which of course it isn't. It's about this. So this is another. This is an article from today. Man killed in California mass overdose incident, which left 12 others hospitalised, and he's now been identified as a 34-year-old Aris Turner of Chico. He died at the scene. At least a dozen others were transported to hospital, according to Newsweek here, for treatment after authorities responded to a 9/11 call on Saturday morning at around a 9 a.m. local time. Exposure to or ingestion of the deadly opioid fentanyl mixed with another substance is suspected to have caused the overdose, affecting both the victims and two officers who responded to the incident. Now, fentanyl and opium derivatives like heroin and other things have become a crisis for the United States. Trump said in the run-up to the general election, which made him president, that he wanted to deal with this issue. The wall is part of that. He's dealing with the migration issue by putting money into Mexico and helping Mexico and other Central and Southern American countries deal with their economies to try to stop the causes of the migration in the first place. But the wall is to deal with the drugs transportation across that border. And he's been talking about this for a very long time. For The Guardian to suggest that they don't know why he wants to build it is a deliberate blind eye, isn't it?
Yes. Because they don't like the politics and therefore they're going to be obtuse in the reporting, which is what it's about, I think. Well, if we stay on the states, we had this sent through to us this morning. We've been following what's been happening in the American military for some time, and it does not look good. And of course, UK Column News has reported on the collisions that took place. This was back in 2017, but we were certainly reporting last year on collisions between American warships, particularly the Pacific Fleet, American Pacific Fleet, and tankers and cargo ships, in which a number of American sailors were killed. And these were very strange events, because you would imagine that a warship was well equipped with professionally trained people and sensors to certainly avoid collisions if it's to be able to fight as a warship. But here's the news headline. We've just chosen this from Australia because it had a particularly good picture. But leaked USS Fitzgerald report paints a damning picture of a dysfunctional ship and crew. The radar was haunted. The crew didn't know what to do. And the commanders weren't talking. So says a damning report into the 2017 collision of a US warship which left seven of its sailors dead. We're going to just dig into this a little bit, because this sort of thing is happening in Britain's military as well. A breakdown of morale, professionalism, discipline in some cases, and there's a reason for it. But let's follow along with the story here in the States. So we've got Navy Times, worse than you thought, inside the secret Fitzgerald probe the Navy doesn't want you to read. Well, this was part of it, a scathing internal probe into the collision that drowned seven sailors on the guided missile destroyer Fitzgerald details a far longer list of problems plaguing the vessel, its crew and superior commands than the service has publicly admitted. This is key, Mike. We've got serious events inside the military, but the American government, as with the Ministry of Defence in this country, likes to keep it secret from the public. But the report continues, obtained by the Navy Times, the dual purpose investigation was overseen by Rear Admiral Brian Fort, and it was submitted 41 days after the June 17, 2017 tragedy. It was kept secret from the public in part because it was designed to prepare the Navy for potential lawsuits in the aftermath of the incident. Unsparingly, Fort and his team of investigators outlined critical lapses by bridge watch standards on the night of the collision with the Philippine flag container vessel ACX Crystal in a bustling maritime corridor off the coast of Japan. And it goes on, it says the report documents the routine, almost casual violations of standing orders on the Fitz bridge that often lacked skippers and executive officers, even during potentially dangerous voyages at night through busy waterways. And it then had this to say, the probe exposes how personal distrust led the officer of the deck, that's the officer of the watch for us here in UK, Lieutenant JG Sarah Coppock, to avoid communicating with the destroyer's electronic nerve centre, the Combat Information Centre, while the Fitzgerald tried to cross a shipping superhighway. Now, this is an incredible statement because the two, the bridge and the CIC team should be working together. The CIC would have crews looking at radars, access to sonar information, electronic warfare information. They're building a picture. That picture should be provided to the bridge. But this young officer wasn't in communication. Now, that may be because she knew the state of that CIC, and the report goes on to talk about bottles filled with urine, weightlifting equipment, rubbish, discarded clothes. This is major breakdown, Mike. But is it possible that the reason that the young lady was not communicating with the CIC was a breakdown in some personal relationship? And I'm going to say here that maybe some of our lady viewers may find some of these comments hard, but I'm going to make the comments because we have seen a steady pattern of breakdown of discipline inside Britain's armed forces as a result of a desperation to get men and women operating in the military together. Now, this was a report that we did back in, I think, about 2016, where we had first Sea Lord Admiral Sir Philip Jones saying that work is underway to gain agreement for women to be accommodated in the same rooms as men while at Commando Training Centre, Royal Marines, allowing them to maintain, quote, team cohesion and ensure equality of opportunity. You're smiling, Mike, and we know why, because we've got young men, young women, put in a similar space. Are the men in particular going to be concentrating on the job in hand, or are they going to be concentrating on the young women? I think that one's pretty easy. But according to the first Sea Lord, no, everything's going to be fine. They're going to get on. I say that the young women are being used as part of a government social engineering policy. So don't misinterpret all of what I'm saying as being simply the men's side. I think the women are being very callously used. And of course, other women are prepared to help this along. So we reported this at the time, 2016, I think. So we have this lady saying that there are currently 3,150 women serving in the Navy out of a total of 31,000 personnel. They make up 9%. But the number of women joining is dropping. So we've got problems with army recruiting, but we've got dropping here. She says, for example, in 1987, and that was before the RENS was integrated, 21% of the total number of people joining up to the Navy were female. Now the inflow of women into the organisation is not even at 10%. So we've cut the numbers and the numbers of women are dropping. But of course, the point is that the women didn't want to join the Navy. They wanted to join the RENS. They weren't going to go to sea. But this is political policy, of course, being driven through. We get senior people pick up on it. Hot-blooded men and women want to have sex, so inevitably there will be the odd incident. Why does he think it's only going to be an odd incident?
Well, if an odd incident results in a ship crashing into a tanker, then that becomes a bit of a problem, doesn't it?
That is a bit of a problem, yes. But when they're going off to do their Tarzan course, the Royal Marine Training course, the last thing that will be on their mind will be sex. What planet is this elderly gentleman on? He's clearly never experienced shared sex military operations and accommodation himself, but he's saying, don't worry, it'll be great. And he's certainly not concerned at the lowering of Royal Marine standards to achieve the equality targets. So the overall policy is designed to break down discipline and professional performance and speed the route to the genderless society, because of course women are now under attack themselves from the fact we can have men identifying as women in order to use women's toilet facilities, for example. So as we have warned about the state of the military, we'll just remind viewers and listeners that if we look at the statistics showing the number of people involved, back from 1993, I think it is, We're talking over 250,000 servicemen and women. We're now down at, what is it, just under 150,000, I think, now in total. So a really substantial drop. And at the same time, of course, we're seeing that Britain's military is itself being subsumed into that unified EU military structure. It's policy, Mike. And when we ask the question, where's the policy coming from? The backbench MPs don't know, but it's coming from somewhere deep in the Cabinet Office. We'll leave it there. Thanks very much for joining us. We will be back at the same time on Wednesday.
On Friday.
On Friday, even.
Yes.
It is a very bad year so far in 2019. We will be back on Friday.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.